Good evening and welcome to a special joint episode of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You from Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. And tonight we will sound a bit different than we normally do, as we are all in remote locations practicing social distancing. So Cliff Shackelford is at home in Nacogdoches. Beverly Burton is at her home here in Shreveport. And I am at home doing the show. And Troy Jones and Wally Derleth are the only people at the station right now. Troy is manning our helm right now, and Wally will be taking your calls tonight. We ask that tonight you please be patient as you call in, as we only have one phone volunteer, Wally Derleth, and he may have his hands full from time to time. Tonight we feature Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, along with our resident entomologist at Red River Radio, Dr. Beverly Burton. They will take your calls about the avian world and the insect world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has had since 1997, and he's been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. Dr. Beverly Burton is our resident entomologist and associate professor of biology, of biological sciences, that is, at LSU Shreveport, a position she has held since 1995. Cliff and Beverly, I wish that you were in the same studio with me tonight, but we're all being safe tonight. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing just great. I'm glad to be back on the air after the long winter.
There you go.
Yeah, same here. It's it's interesting how we're all separated, but technology is bringing us together, and I hope everybody can hear us okay, and we're ready to get this show on the road.
All right. Well, we'd love to have calls right away tonight, folks. Bird Calls and What's Bugging You, two popular programs on our radio station. Dr. Burton, you've been doing this show, gosh, since before I got here. So that was probably early 2000s, I suppose. How long?
No, I started back in about 1998, I believe.
Okay. So you've been doing this for a while. And Cliff, I think we're on the fifth or sixth year for your show, are we not?
Yeah, we started in June of 2013, so in June we'll have our seventh year anniversary.
Oh, well, there you go. Time flies when you're having fun. We invite everybody to call in tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Tonight we're taking questions about the avian world and the interplay between the insect world. As most of us know, bugs make a very fine dinner for many, many birds, but not all bugs make a fine dinner for the birds. So we will leave it to our experts to tell us.
Thank you for calling which fine the birds special are program dying on. Of What's Bugging You and Bird Calls.
Okay, yeah, there you go. That was Wally Derleth there, and we just heard him answering a phone call. So, Cliff, we're going to open up right now with a question about the importance of pollinators, and both you and Beverly should chime in on that. Pollination is something that has become very, very prevalent over the last 15 years or so, as we've seen a decline in honeybees and other types of bees that are primary pollinators. Talk a bit about the various pollination efforts that various birds and insects do for us.
Yeah, there are certainly a lot more insects that are pollinators than birds, but there are some that are important that are birds. But pollination is one of those ecosystem services that we've taken for granted forever. And if you like to eat food, you need to love your pollinators, because they're creating a lot of the things that we eat and drink. If it wasn't for pollinators, we wouldn't have coffee in the morning. We wouldn't have tea. We wouldn't have a lot of the grapes that make wine. How about agave or tequila that a lot of bats help pollinate? And then just a whole bunch of food. Some estimates are about every third bite in your diet is thanks to a pollinator. So unless we all want to be really skinny and miss out on a lot of fruits and vegetables and things that are super healthy, we need our pollinators.
Yes, and the best way to support the pollinators in the ecosystem is to have as many native plants as you can, rather than artificial cultivars, and that will help the pollinators. We have, a lot of people think that only honeybees pollinate, but there are a lot of different types of bees that pollinate. By the way, honeybees are not native to the United States. They actually brought honeybees over from Europe when they settled Jamestown. But there's also a lot of beetles that are pollinators. There are some wasps that are pollinators. And so even though the honeybees have been in decline for somewhat over the years, they are bouncing back. And that's good news. It's part of the decline was due to a mite. A mite is a small arachnid that's kind of like a spider, but there are parasites on the bees, and also due to a fungal infection. But pollinators, very important.
I know I've seen carpenter bees out along the road near me because there's a field of crimson clover over there, and I've gone over there and tried to snap some photos. Those are fast little bugs, you know. They just don't sit and pawn for you, you know. But so carpenter bees, what other kinds of bees are specifically pollinators?
There are honeybees, there are carpenter bees, there are solitary bees that are called mason bees, and they will pollinate as well. And so just, I can't name them all. There's so many.
And it goes beyond bees. There are a lot of beetles. Beetles, yeah, might be the largest order. They're clumsy. They get in there. They get a lot of pollen on. They're not agile like a lot of the bees and flies. And then don't forget butterflies and moths, too.
That's right.
Okay, and we do have our first caller online, John from Fishkill, Louisiana. You're on with Cliff and Beverly. What's your question tonight?
Okay, I got a question for Miss Beverly. It's about the gnats that are, they come this time of the year, but this year, they seem to be really more aggressive, and I have a bunch of chickens, and they're just tearing those chickens up every night. My question is, do these purple lights that attract bugs and electrocute the bugs, will that eliminate some of those gnats?
Not enough of them. They're only going to be able to kill a small portion. The thing about all flies is they're immatures or maggots, and maggots have to have a moist organic environment to develop in. And the problem is that maybe they're not so much, the problem is perhaps they're not so much more aggressive, but there's just more of them with all the rain we've had. And until it dries up, don't expect those populations to go down very much.
Boy, the poor hens, they just scratch all night long. They just constantly. So I'll have to find some kind of poison to spray in there, I guess.
Yeah, I would use something just generic. Read the label of the insecticide bottle, and if the active ingredient ends in the suffix THRIN, that's a pyrethrin, that would be the best for you to use around the chickens.
Okay, thanks a lot. And I also will make a big old dust bowl for them using diatomaceous earth. That'll get the hens coated with that will actually kill an insect.
Probably.
Yeah. Thank you for your help. Keep up the good work, you guys.
Thanks for your call, John.
Thank you, John. And we do have another call online. But first, let me remind you that you're listening to a special edition of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You from Red River Radio. Cliff Shackelford and Dr. Beverly Burden are online tonight to answer your questions about birds and insects. Any questions regarding those two or the interplay between those two is welcome. And we have David from Fort Polk coming up next for Cliff. David, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
So I was just wondering, so as I'm sure everyone's noticed, the swallows are back from migration. And last year we had some build a little mud nest on our front porch. I want to say they're barn swallows.
Okay.
And so they built the nest, and we got to watch them as they laid eggs, and the eggs hatched, and we got to watch them hatch, and as the baby birds started to fly. And we never tore down the nest, and now a couple of swallows have come back and laid some more eggs in the nest. And I was just curious, the likelihood that it may be the same swallows, do they return to the same nest, or maybe one of the offspring returns to the same nest, or is it likely just a brand new set?
Yeah, without being able to mark the birds, we don't know which one is Bob and which one's Sue and which one's Jimmy. So it's really tough to know the answer, but likely that is a returning bird because it knew exactly where to go. But then you got to think about, well, these birds are, when they're flying around, the knowledgeable ones can see a porch and realize that's a good spot to put a nest. But the chances are pretty good that your bird is a returning bird. Now, whether its mate is also a returning bird, that's another story. You know, these swallows, once they fledge their young, the male and female go their separate ways. They might not ever see each other again, certainly not in migration or on the wintering grounds. But the chances are that if, you know, if they survive the winter and the long trek, because barn swallows go to South America, Central and South America, they could end up back there and nesting on your porch. Now, I'm guessing that some of that mud nest deteriorated over the winter and that they probably modified it and put some fresh mud on there. Is that the case, David? Did they do any addition to the architecture?
They added a little bit onto it and did some repairs.
Yeah, that seems to be very important, because a lot of times that when that mud dries for months and months, it gets crumbly and falls down, but it leaves a little bit of a lip, and that can be an easy starting point to add new fresh mud for the current breeding season. So that's cool. A lot of people don't like swallows on their porch because the birds become what I call good parents. They perceive us and our pets as being threats, and so they dive bomb us. So what I like to remind people is that these swallows are such good neighbors. They're eating a lot of pesky flies and other insects that bother us. And how about use the side door, the back door, for the next few weeks? That could avoid you getting dive bombed and allow those swallows to continue being good parents and raise their young.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, David.
All right. Thank you, David. And we are remind you, we're listening to Bird Calls and What's Bugging You from Red River Radio. Tonight's program is being remote dialed in from all locations across Louisiana and Texas. And you can call in tonight with your questions about both the bird world and the insect world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. All lines are open right now, so you'll get right in. We do have a question that a caller submitted. They didn't want to go on the air. And this is a good question for you, Dr. Burton. Can mosquitoes transmit the coronavirus? Beverly? She's muted.
It's a new virus, and it's a coronavirus, and coronaviruses at this time have not been shown to be transmitted by mosquitoes. And let me explain that a little more. There's about 160 different species of mosquitoes in the Arklatex area. Yet there's only three genera. There's Aedes, there's Culex, and there's Anopheles. The type of mosquitoes can actually transmit the diseases. The Aedes transmits yellow fever type diseases. The Anopheles transmits malaria, and the Culex type mosquitoes will transmit the West Nile virus. So if they can transmit the coronavirus, it would probably be the Culex type of a species. But let me explain a little bit about what happens when a mosquito sucks the blood out of an animal. It's like that they're injecting two hypodermic needles. With one hypodermic needle, they are extracting the blood. With the other hypodermic needle, they're actually injecting their saliva in there. So if a mosquito bites somebody that says has yellow fever or malaria, they take it up in that blood mill. It goes into their gut. Insects have what we call a open circulatory system, which means they don't have arteries and veins. The blood just kind of sloshes around in the body. And so in order for a mosquito to transmit either a virus or a bacteria or even a protozoan, which is the case in malaria, Protozoans are small single cell organisms that has to go from their gut to their blood and then travel up to their salivary glands and enter into their salivary glands. And that's a very complicated process. And there's some bacteria that can do that and viruses that can do that, but most of them cannot. So I doubt if they can transmit the coronavirus, because coronaviruses are a specific type of virus, and they've never been, we've never shown transmission of a coronavirus.
Well, let's hope that they can't. You are listening to What's Bugging You and Bird Calls from Red River Radio, a special edition tonight with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist, and Dr. Beverly Burton, our resident entomologist. And you can call in right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. All lines are open right now, so you'll get right in. For both of you, over half of the species of birds on the planet are insectivores. Of which insects around here are important to birds, and which insects around here we wish were important to birds but are not?
Well, I'll say that a lot of our birds are eating grasshoppers. Those will be a lot of your grassland species. Even our backyard birds that we are fond of with seed feeders like cardinals, they switch to insects when they have young in the nest. They don't feed their young those hard, dry sunflower seeds. Instead, those cardinal adults go and switch and eat, grab all kinds of different soft, fleshy insects to feed their young. So there's a huge long list that I'm not going to be able to provide that these birds feed their young, but I'm thinking back to the grassland comment that grasshoppers are a big deal. There are several raptors that eat dragonflies. And so there are Mississippi kites that we see in the Arklatex area. Those are very fond of dragonflies. So the list is long. As you mentioned earlier, about half of our birds on the planet are insectivores. And that doesn't really include the birds like the cardinal I mentioned that switch and eat, or at least capture insects part of the year to feed their young. And I'm sure some of those cardinals they imbibe in some of those insects they catch. They don't feed them all to their young.
Beverly?
Yeah, mainly what I see a lot of times are caterpillars. They'll feed on caterpillars. And if you look at the way that robins forage, they have a certain type of a pattern. Cliff can talk about that a little bit. But they're oftentimes looking at the little caterpillars that are in the grass, and they'll take those. Caterpillars are nice, soft. They have a lot of protein. They have fat bodies in them that allow for a lot of good nourishment for the insects, for the birds.
Yeah, and that's great that you reminded me about several of the larvae of several moths like geometrid and noctuid moths that are really, they're up there in the canopy. The eggs are laid in the new buds of the trees. The larvae hatch and start eating on, say, pecan leaves that are budding. Well, the warblers and the vireos and a lot of other songbirds come along and keep those moth numbers in check. And so Beverly's right. They're eating a lot of those soft-bodied caterpillars, namely those moths that I mentioned. They're really tiny. When they emerge as adults, they're just, you know, nondescript little moths that are white or tannish, and we don't ever think about them, but they lay perfectly sized eggs that become perfectly sized caterpillar that a lot of our beloved warblers and vireos and other songbirds like to eat up in the canopy. So the birds are helping us keep a lot of the insects in check. I'm not saying that my birds were designed to eat all of Beverly's bugs. That's certainly not the case. There's a balance. And so Beverly doesn't want all of her insects to reach adulthood. None of us do. So we want to see a balance, and that's what's going on out there. You see this ecosystem where you've got predator prey and you've got big numbers of prey and smaller numbers of predators, and you get some sort of balance achieved over time.
I've got a question, a follow-up for you, Beverly. A couple of years ago, you brought in a pus caterpillar, and these were spotted on the LSU campus. And I know from Florida, there were many caterpillars down there that folks told you do not touch the caterpillars because they had poisonous stings and would either irritate you, maybe make you sick. Are there birds that can actually digest these caterpillars that are specifically poisonous or negatively reactive with human beings?
There are some. The classic example is the monarch caterpillar. It feeds on milkweeds. Milkweeds have certain, they're called cardioglycosides in them that will make birds throw up, sick to their stomach. But also Cliff talked about a certain group of moths called noctuids. Noctuids are these nondescript little brown moths, and they are, their caterpillars are large pests in both backyard gardens and in agricultural fields. And so what I tell people about caterpillars is caterpillars come in two classic types, smooth or spiky and hairy. If they're smooth, you can probably go ahead and pick them up. But if they have any spikes or hairs on them, just leave those alone because you really don't know what you're getting into. Because especially like the little pus caterpillar, those hairs are distinctively, they have a tip on them. And when that tip breaks off, it will have a venom in there that can irritate the skin extremely so. And so the best thing yet is just don't pick up hairy or spiky caterpillars in any form. Just leave them alone.
And how about millipedes? I know they're in a different class, but you see millipedes all over the place. I don't hear a lot about poisonous millipedes.
What millipedes do, they can exude a very foul-smelling chemical that's its primary predator defense. And I don't know if birds eat millipedes. I wouldn't think that they would. Yeah, what do you think, Cliff?
They're pretty chitinous. Chitin is the protein that's the building block of a lot of insect exoskeletons, our own hair, our fingernails, bird feathers. And so if you pick up a millipede, you'll notice it's pretty hard-shelled and what we call chitinous. And there are not many birds that really like that. There's no nutritional value from eating that, just like they are not going to eat, not many things eating fingernails and hair. There's no nutritional value. So there's not a lot of flesh. It's a lot of work to get to a millipede's fleshy part, and I think that most birds avoid them.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to What's Bugging You and Bird Calls, a special edition from Red River Radio. And we have our phone lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist, and Dr. Beverly Burton, our resident entomologist, are both online waiting to take your calls. And all lines are open right now, so you'll get right in. Now, we do have a question from the son of somebody I know. Do birds have vocal cords?
Well, birds are way more specialized in that department than humans. They have what's called a syrinx, and so they can make multiple sounds as the air passes through that voice box, that syrinx. So what we typically call vocal cords are pretty reduced compared to the bird's syrinx. So that's why there are several birds that can make multiple sounds at once, and often our ears can't pick that up, but we can see that on what we call a spectrograph. And so so the answer is that birds have a souped up system to make more sounds, more intricate sounds and multiple sounds through what's called a syrinx.
Okay. And once again, you are listening to What's Bugging You and Bird Calls, a special edition, and you can call in now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. 952-8502. And we have another question here submitted, and it's regarding chicks. We hear a lot about Lyme disease being passed from ticks to humans. Why don't we hear more about Rocky Mountain spotted fever?
The reason we don't hear more about Rocky Mountain spotted fever is that it's just geographically not here. And it doesn't, if it is here, then it occurs at a very, very low level. Whereas Lyme disease is very prevalent. When ticks bite you, they are inserting their mouth parts. It's called a rostrum, and a hypostyle is where, and as they're feeding on the blood, then they can also release certain bacteria or viruses into your system. Lyme disease is very prevalent here. It's caused by the bacteria Borrelia burgdorferi, and the ticks are here, and so that's why we don't hear too much about it.
Okay. And for those listening, you are listening to a special edition of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You with Cliff Shackelford and Dr. Beverly Burton. And our phone lines are open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding birds, the insect world, or the interplay between the two is welcome tonight. And I have a question for you, Dr. Burton, about ladybugs. Popular ladybugs, everybody kind of likes ladybugs, but do birds eat them, or do the bright red and black colorations of the insect imply a toxicity or a distasteful flavor?
I've never eaten a ladybug, so I wouldn't know if they were distasteful. I think a bird would have to eat quite a few ladybugs to get much nutrition out of them, but I've never seen a bird eating a ladybug, so I really don't know the answer to that. Ladybugs are very, very beneficial to have because they're voracious feeders on aphids. Aphids are sometimes called plant lice, and they can destroy a plant very, very quickly. They basically are like the mosquitoes, except they're feeding on the plants and they're sucking all the plant juices out. And so it's good to have lady beetles around to keep the aphid population down.
Cliff, do you know
if they feed on ladybugs?
No, I can't think of any bird that would even specialize in that. I don't think that they'd pass one up, but I don't even think I've ever seen where these big outbreaks or these big winter hordes. I've never seen birds camping out there. Versus if you see a termite explosion at the right time, you'll see a lot of birds benefiting and consuming those winged forms of the termites as they start to spread out and try to build their own colony. There are a lot of birds that capitalize on that. That's not as chitinous, very fleshy, very easy to catch, versus the very tough ladybugs.
All right. So the ladies are tough. That's what we needed to hear.
That's right.
You are listening to Bird Calls, a special edition with What's Bugging You from Red River Radio. And tonight's program may sound a bit different as we are all in remote locations practicing social distancing. So Cliff is in Nacogdoches, Beverly is at her home, and I'm at my home now. Troy Jones is manning the helm there, and Wally Derlis is trying to take your phone calls. And we do invite you to call in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we do have a caller up, and that is Bridget from Calhoun, Louisiana. Bridget, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Well, I've got a couple of red birds. And I guess we would formally call them cardinals. And They seem to be very aggressive towards particularly my husband's truck. If he doesn't fold his truck mirrors in when he parks, they will sit on the ledge of the mirror and just claw it. And since he started folding the mirrors in, now they've moved on to stand on the toolbox and get at the back glass. And I'm just so curious, is there anything that you know of that could deter them from doing that, or what causes them to? Are they just kind of mirror boxing there?
Yep, they're seeing their mirrored reflection. Their brain is too small to figure out that it's their own reflection. But to them, they're supercharged with hormones. They're very territorial, and they see that other male. Sometimes females do the same thing. They see another female, and they'll peck at it. And so they like mirrors. They'll go to windows of the house, of the car. The good thing is they're not going to hurt the glass. I don't think a cardinal's even going to scratch the paint. That's a tiny, light bird. It doesn't weigh more than a couple of coins in your pocket. So I wouldn't worry about it. I'd let them do their thing. If it really bothers you, you know, I know people throw towels over the mirrors that don't retract like yours do. And another thing you can do is just park it somewhere else. So it's maybe out of the bird's territory, or you don't see it if it bothers you. But I really don't see that they're going to damage anything or scratch anything. It's just a bird seeing its reflection. It's territorial, and it's not happy about it. It thinks that the intruder is trying to take over and commandeer that territory. And actually, regarding cardinals, I've noticed in my backyard over the last couple of weeks, my wife and I have noticed, because we're doing more backyard bird watching with stay-home orders, but the cardinals are really duking it out. And in the dead of winter, we counted 17 cardinals in our wildscape and going to our feeder and going to our berry-giving shrubs and trees that we provide. And that is not a year-round thing. That's a winter thing. But once spring comes and it's time to make babies, these birds start arguing over a piece of land to call their own. We do the same thing. We put fences up. We put barbed wire up. So birds are battling right now. We've seen quite a few cardinal males. They kind of get in this duel where they lay flat, really low and flat on the grass or on the sidewalk. And they're maybe 3 or 4 feet apart, and they're looking at each other. And it's kind of like if you've ever seen a cockfight, it's a little bit reminiscent of a cockfight. And that's exactly what they're doing, is they're fighting over that piece of property to call their own. But in your case, the bird just doesn't ever figure out that, hey, this is a reflection of myself. Instead, it's just gonna be in hyperdrive with hormones that tell it to protect, protect, protect.
Yeah. It's kind of comical because at some evenings he'll park the truck, and before he can even, you know, get his lunchbox out of the back seat, that bird is swooping in, almost taking his hat off to get there. So it's kind of comical.
Yeah, I've waited for a car company to get a picture of the competition and say, hey, you don't want their brand. Look what happens. You want our brand. But it has nothing to do with the brand, of course. But there are a lot of other birds that do that. We hear a lot of eastern bluebirds do that, mockingbirds. And one that's really cool that I've never had as a yard bird, including when I lived in Central Texas, roadrunners. So people that live in West Texas, Central Texas, where roadrunners are common and might be a backyard bird. And if you have sliding glass doors that go all the way to the ground, the roadrunner will find his reflection and tap on it. What's so funny is they'll call our department saying, hey, did anybody lose a pet roadrunner? Because he's tapping on the glass, he wants to come inside. And so after a little chuckle, we have to remind him that, no, that's a wild bird. He doesn't want to come inside. I'm sure it's lovely in your house, but he sees the reflection. And so what you need to do when that bird flies off is go out there yourself at the same time where the lighting is just so, and you'll get 5 inches from that glass, and guess what? You're going to see a reflection of yourself. And so then you can really get a good grasp of what's going on with these funny birds that are doing funny things.
Yeah. Well, I certainly appreciate that, and I'm enjoying the show. Thank you guys so much.
Great. Thank you, Bridget.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Go ahead, John.
Cliff, this is not really a normal question. I got some month-old baby chicks. They've just about fully feathered. And then my grandkid brought over 4 ducks. They were about 3 weeks old, not quite fully feathered. And we had to put them together just because it was some cold nights.
Yeah.
And we went out and check on them, and we didn't see the ducks. The ducks were just sitting there on the ground under the chicks. The chicks had just roosted on them because apparently those ducks were warmer than the ground. But I just couldn't figure out how ducks and chickens could do that.
That's pretty cool. So you're saying the chickens were literally standing on the backs of the ducks?
Well, they were just roosting, just squatting down on ducks.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, just really weird. And I thought maybe you had an idea of maybe.
No, and they were all happy, so I'm happy, and I'm sure you're happy, so that's good.
Well, it was just sort of weird, and I thought if anybody knew the answer to that, you would.
Yeah. No, I've not experienced that, but that's pretty neat to hear about, John. Thanks for the call.
I wonder if the ducks have a higher body temperature than the chicks.
Well, ducks certainly have a lot more feathering than chickens.
Yeah.
So that would suggest, you know, think about what we used to make down, or still do make down, coats out of.
True.
Waterfowl feathers.
Yeah.
It's a lot warmer. So I would think that the duck is a lot warmer because of that. Yeah.
That was my guess. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Cool. Very cool. Thanks, John.
All right. Thanks, John. And I am back, guys. So technology being what it is, my phone decided it didn't want me talking with you guys anymore. So, you know, it's Hal. I always blame Hal on everything. So you are listening to Bird Calls and What's Bugging You, a special edition with Cliff Shackelford and Dr. Beverly Burden. And we have one line open right now. And Luke from Leesville, you are on next with Cliff and Beverly. What's your question?
Hi, guys. We just had a nasty spell of weather come through just 2 days ago, and we had a tornado warning in it. Since you guys are on the line, just curious, do we see any interesting behavior changes either before or after that kind of severe weather for both birds and bugs, just like for tornadoes or hurricanes, since that we're in the area?
I wouldn't think it would have much of an impact on the insect world. Insects are extremely resilient, and they're survivors. And so I would think it would have very, very small impact. And I don't think there would be any change in behavior.
Yeah, and for birds, what comes to mind is when we have a lot of rain and nowhere for the water to go, and you're a grassland or ground nesting bird, sometimes those nests can get swamped by heavy rains, but the birds are typically hardwired to re-nest. So a change of behavior would be to not give up. And so they would re-nest. But no, I think, like Beverly said, that these are common occurrences or even uncommon occurrences when they're a hurricane. But I've mentioned this before on the show. We experienced Hurricane Ike in 2008. And when that went over, it was still Hurricane Force 1 winds over Nacogdoches. And when it did, we still had a hummingbird coming to our feeder, and the trees all around were just whipping and blowing, and we could hear limbs snapping. The air was full of smell of pine resin and hardwood sap from limbs snapping, and the little hummingbird didn't really care. He'd still come into this feeder that was swaying in the wind. And yellow-throated vireo was, our backyard yellow-throated vireo was just singing away during the peak of the storm. So I think that, you know, it depends on the time of the day when a storm hits. I recall it was morning when Ike hit. It was definitely daytime. I don't remember the exact hour, but it didn't really impact those birds I mentioned. But certainly the impact of hurricanes, for example, when Harvey hit on the Texas coast, it wiped out a lot of the pollinating plant, pollinating plants that a lot of our birds rely on. And so we mentioned that pollination earlier in the call or earlier in the show, but Harvey, the wind and the rain stripped a lot of the plants, and the problem, the worry was that here come ruby-throated hummingbirds. So Harvey hit around the peak of southbound ruby-throated hummingbird. migration. And so without a lot of the plants to feed on in a very localized area, a lot of the bird watchers got together and started putting potted plants out quickly and putting out more feeders and compensating for that loss. The good thing is Harvey's footprint is not, you know, any hurricane footprint is fairly small on the greater scale of things. So there would be a lot of ruby-throated hummingbirds that were not impacted by Harvey. They would go a different route, or they got through before Harvey or waited a little later. So it doesn't impact the whole population in a lot of these storms, and that's good. But that overall, Luke, that's a good question and one that we could probably sit around the coffee shop, you know, 6 feet apart and talk about, because there's a lot of neat examples of how resilient a lot of these birds and insects are and other critters with storms.
Well, that's pretty interesting stuff. Thanks for taking the call.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Luke. And we're going to go to our next caller online right now. And that is, if I can get up there, Richard from Longview. You are on with Cliff and Dr. Burden. What's your question?
Yes, the question is for Cliff. I work down in South Texas a lot. And the many years I've been down through there, we noticed some buzzards down there. We see our normal buzzards we see here in Northeast Texas, but these have got white tips and white heads. They call them Mexican buzzards down there.
Yeah.
And I see a lot of them down there. And I noticed I was in Sulphur Springs here a while back at two different occasions, and I've seen some up there. Are those moving further north, you think, or what kind are they?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Richard. That's a good one. That is the crested caracara, and it's actually not a buzzard, but it does feed alongside buzzards. They do like easy pickings like roadkill, and they'll work with the buzzards on getting rid of that roadkill. But it's actually more closely related to falcons, like the peregrine falcon. It's in the same family, and it's again the crested caracara. And like you noted, they're really common down in South Texas. They like that brush country, and so there's also a few populations that hop and skip up the Oaks and Prairies up towards Sulphur Springs, and they've been there forever. And so I remember seeing as a kid, my lifer caracara, when I grew up in Dallas, we took a trip, drove I-20 out east. And when we got to about Terrell, somewhere near Kaufman County, I saw caracaras there. And so they're up in Sulphur Springs. That's not very far from there. They're just these little relic populations of caracaras that have hung on. And so they're not really new. They've been there for a while, and they're just very localized. And that's cool that you've seen them. We've had a few records in East Texas here in the last few years. In fact, the Christmas bird count back in December, my team saw a caracara over Alizan Bayou Wildlife Management Area, which is between Nacogdoches and Lufkin. And that's a pretty good sighting that we were getting maybe a couple of year of sightings. And they seem to be one day wonders, meaning that they're not easy to refine. They're here and then they're gone. So you better hurry and take a picture. And so I just don't think they like the heavy forested areas of East Texas, because they're more of an open country bird. And where you do see them, often it's in pasture land or along roadsides eating roadkill. But again, that's the crested caracara. Okay. And that's a good observation, Richard, that you've been seeing them.
Well, I know some of the ranch hands down at the ranchers down in South Texas. We talked to a few of them, and they don't like them because they told stories about they get newly born calves, and they said they would actually peck their eyes out and then wait for the mother would leave the calf, and coyotes would kill them, and they would get the leftover sometimes. I don't know about that. But.
Yeah, I think caracaras and black vultures often get a bad rap for doing what they do. It's another ecosystem service of cleaning the landscape of dead and decaying animal matter. And so if you come up on a caracara on a dead animal, you shouldn't assume that it killed it. So often those calves are stillborn or sickly, and the mother knows best and might walk away from a sickly calf. And the caracaras and the vultures are there to do their job. But as far as being, you know, big killers, that's one thing vultures and caracaras aren't really adept at. They're not really good at seizing prey. They have weak feet. So I would challenge those ranchers to see the whole event play out. In other words, to not just walk up on a dead calf and have guilt by association. Instead, have the fortune of coming up on the birth and seeing that it is indeed healthy, and whether or not these vultures and caracaras are doing. Otherwise, to me, it's a lot of myth.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, Cliff, thank you for the information.
Yeah. And if, you know, if that, Richard, if that is rampant, I don't see any shortage of livestock.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. All right. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you very much.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls and What's Bugging You, a special edition from Red River Radio. And as we all sound a little bit different tonight, it's because we're all practicing remote location call-in and social distancing that way. So Cliff Shackelford is at his home in Nacogdoches. Dr. Burden is in her home here in Shreveport. And I am in my home with Troy Jones and manning our master control board, and Wally Derleth handling the phones tonight. And we have Ben from Dry Prong coming up next. Ben, for Dr. Burden, what's your question?
I have a question about them. Well, I've got two, if you don't mind. Them biting gnats have been bad the last couple of years, and off is on it seems to be not as effective as it should be. I was wondering if the skin's so soft or something like that might be more effective. And also them gorgeous little pea-green cockroaches with the almost translucent silver wings that you find on dead wood. Is there something I call those other than them pretty green roaches? Or...
Well, let's do the biting gnat question first, and it's because of the weather. We've had very wet weather the last 2 years, and anytime you have wet weather, then the flies and the gnats are just going, and the mosquitoes are going to be a lot more noticeable than that. And I love the roach question. A lot of people think that the only roaches that exist are the big or the little brown ones. But there's actually many, many different types of species of cockroaches. And there's only a handful of them that will lower themselves to live with humans. And the little green cockroaches, they're about 3/4 of an inch in length. And those do come into the collection from time to time. And when they do, I like to really show them off to let people know that there are beautiful cockroaches in the world. Thank you for your call, Ben.
Thank you much, ma'am.
All right, and you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. We have some lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And not a lot of time left, so you may want to go ahead and get your call in now. But we do go next to Robert from Alexandria. Robert, you have a question for both Dr. Burden and Cliff Shackelford. What's your question? Hello, Robert.
Can you hear me?
Oh, okay. Yes, we can hear you now, Robert. Go ahead with your question.
Oh, okay. The question is, really, how is the fact that human beings are not out driving and not out in nature, how is that? Has that affected the way the insect population is, and has it affected the way that the birds are interacting with the ecology?
I don't think it's had any impact on the insect world at all. I'm a loss for words here for a second. Like I said, insects and humans, most insects don't interact that much with humans. We only notice the pesty ones. And so I would think it would have zero impact at all. What about the birds, Cliff?
Yeah, I think pretty much the same thing. You know, we're stuck at home. We can look at nature a lot more. I wanted to encourage people to get out and look at the different birds and insects in their yard. Encourage your kids to get out there and look at them and try to identify them. You use a bird book, an insect book. You can use the internet. You don't have to buy a book if you don't want to. But that's a lot of fun. And then you can figure out how are we maybe tied to these species. But for birds, I think one big conservation issue on the coast are too many people in boats getting on rookery islands or nesting islands where you have a lot of birds breeding. And so the hope is that with less people getting out on their boats and fishing and picnicking on these islands, because what happens is they flush the adults off the nest, and then the sun can cook the contents of the nest, either eggs or nestlings. Also, yeah. Predators like laughing gulls can grab the contents of the nest without the parents there. So the unknown harassment that folks are doing, and it's also wildlife photographers are getting way too close to these birds. So I'm hoping that a lot of these people are staying home and letting these nesting island birds along the coast put out a bumper crop year is what my hope is. But yeah, that's a great question, Robert. We could go on and on about interactions, but I think the biggest one I'd like to encourage, and I know Beverly does too, is to and she mentioned this, is to think about the plants that you're putting in your yard. Encourage pollinators by using native plants and getting your family outside as a unit and looking at nature. And so this isn't something you just do once and you're done with it. You ought to think of it as a lifelong process or project to getting these plants developed and looking at the outcome, and it's rewarding. You can see new birds coming to your wildscape, new insects coming to your wildscape. And it's a lot of fun to say, hey, I did this. I had a part of this. And I think that's maybe the biggest thing that I'd like to say about how we are interacting with these critters is what we do impacts them more than anything. And if we're removing habitat, we are making the biggest negative impact. So think about your yard and think about not mowing from fence to fence and dedicating a little chunk to a native little wildscape garden with pollinating plants that can be attractive to hummingbirds, butterflies, honeybees, et cetera.
Yeah, that's great. Dr. Burden, let me ask you one follow-up question, and that is that it's about the gnats. It seems like in years past the mosquitoes have been predominant, but this year the gnats are really out in force.
Yeah, like I said before, it's because of the wet weather. But don't count the mosquitoes out; they're on their way.
Okay, I wasn't rooting for them, but okay.
Nobody's rooting for the mosquitoes. All right, thank you very much, Richard or Robert, and we're going to go to our next call now. Carol from Lufkin, you're on with Cliff and Dr. Burden. What's your question?
Yes, this is just a report for Cliff that last night my husband Jerry and I were sitting on our porch and we had a whippoorwill.
Oh, cool.
Definitely a whippoorwill, three notes and not four, and we both heard it. And,
good.
It was like he was maybe about, I don't know, 100 yards from the house.
Uh-huh.
Very distinct. And then he must have flown maybe 300 yards because we could still hear him, but it was a little further away. And it was about 10 after 8, so it was pretty dark. Light in the sky, but the trees were silhouettes.
That's a great report, Carol. So, yeah, whippoorwills are only a migrant through our listening area. The closest breeding would be the Wachita Mountains and, of course, the Ozark Mountains and farther north. But they start pouring through our area in the latter half of March and all the way through April. So that's really great that you saw one. So the predominant one, I like to remind listeners that the predominant night bird that we hear in the hot summer months in our listening area is the Chuck Will's Widow. And you mentioned that your bird was definitely not a Chuck Will's widow. So that's great, because I think most people don't know that there's two species, but you clearly do. And once you know there's two, you have to figure out how to tell them apart. And you've done that. And that's great, Carol. So thank you for the report. And I'm glad you got to hear a whippoorwill, because that's always a splendid sound.
I was so thrilled. Hadn't heard one since I was a little girl.
Oh, wow. That's even better. Yeah. And that was just 10 years ago.
That you were
a little girl.
Like 60 years ago. But we live about 3 miles north of Lufkin in a acreage, a wooded area near the Moore Farm.
Yeah.
And so
great.
Out the country.
Well, that's neat, Carol. We thank you for the report, and keep listening for those night birds.
All right. And we're going to go to our last caller that we may be able to get online now. Jonathan from Benton, you're on with Cliff and Dr. Burden. What's your question? And please be brief so we can get to it.
Yes. So I'll make this really fast. So first, for the insects, do they have like a lot of unique sounds like birds besides a mosquito going by ear going, you're tasty, or like a hissing cockroach or cricket or cicadas? And my second is, so you see a lot of birds overhead flying flocks. Do they live together, or is that just a migration thing? And that's it.
Real quick about insect noises. They mainly do those by rubbing body parts together. It's called stridulation. And the rule of thumb is, if they can make a noise, they also have a hearing organ that they can also hear. Cliff?
And then a lot of the big flocks we see, like cedar waxwings and common grackles and American robins, they're pretty much hanging out together and migrating together, but they're not going to spend every day of their life together, no.
Oh, that's cool. Great to know. And I love this little crossover, but thank y'all.
They're kind of on a party bus together, but it doesn't last forever. The party's got to end.
Hi. Well, thank y'all. Have a wonderful evening.
Thank you, Jonathan. Great questions.
All right. And you have been listening to a special edition of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You with Dr. Beverly Burden and Cliff Shackelford. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, along with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. They sounded a bit different tonight because we're all practicing from remote locations and social distancing. So Cliff was at his home in Nacogdoches. Dr. Burden was in her home here in Shreveport, and I am in my home. Troy Jones manned our control room, and Wally Derleth had his hands full from time to time answering phones. Before we go, we've got just time for one more brief question, and this is for Cliff and Dr. Burden. How can we enjoy nature while stay-at-home orders are in place?
Stay at home doesn't mean stay inside. So you can get out and enjoy your backyard. A lot of The parks are closed down because they don't want large gathering of people. But I would just say, go for a walk, go out and look, go out and play.
Yeah, I'd agree. And use your ears. Jonathan brought up a good point about animals that make noises. And Carol mentioned the whippoorwill. These are detections made by our ears. So use your ears when you're trying to find birds, and you'll be rewarded even in the most cement-covered urban area. You will find birds and insects everywhere.
All right. Cliff and Dr. Burden, I want to thank both of you for joining us in the comfort of your own home.
Thank you for having us.
Cliff,
thank you.
You have a good night, and we hope everybody will tune in for the next edition of both Bird Calls and What's Bugging You in May. Stay tuned. We have Radio Lab coming up next here on Red River Radio, and we are your community-supported public broadcasting service from LSUS and the voice of the community. The audio for tonight's program will be available on our website shortly, and so you can listen again.